Thank you, Jay and Eric, for your musical gift this morning. That song was written by the Unitarian Universalist folk musician Peter Mayer. It's called Do You Really Want to Know? And it says right at the beginning, the sun once went around the earth, according to the Holy Church. It helped to reassure people that they were the center of the universe. He continues on to discuss Galileo and Darwin, whose scientific discoveries radically altered the way we see the universe and ourselves in it. When the Pope or Darwin's wife ask what these men have found in their studies, their reply, according to the song, is, "Do you really want to know?" But Galileo and Darwin weren't the first to question the mainstream assumptions or those put forth by the religious authorities of their time. One such radical was Lucretius. He lived from approximately 99 to 55 years before the birth of Jesus. Lucretius wrote something called On the Nature of Things over 2,000 years ago. And in it, he claimed some pretty radical things. Quote, "The universe has no creator or designer." He posited that the basic units of matter, we might call them atoms, simply move and bump around, colliding with one another and forming matter in their combinations. And what arises from their combinations in the forms of plants or animals or particular characteristics, he said they continue only when they help the being successfully navigate their environment. Function followed form, he wrote, not the other way around. Quote, "Sight did not exist before the birth of eyes, nor speech before the creation of the tongue." The insight that Lucretius showed two millennia ago is rather mind-boggling. We'll come back to him. Fast forward almost 16 centuries, a man from Pisa, Italy, named Galileo Galilei, was born on February 15th, 1564. So, happy birthday, Galileo. His claim to fame was using a combination of observation, experimentation, and mathematics to support Copernicus's theory of heliocentrism. Heliocentrism is that the sun, heliocentrism states that, contrary to what our senses tell us, the earth is actually moving around the sun, and not the other way around. The sun, he said, is stationary in the universe, and the earth and the other planets revolve in their orbits around this central star. That's heliocentrism. The prevailing view of the time, though, which was held by the church and also the great minds of science, was geocentrism, the idea that the earth was the center of it all, and the sun and the other planets revolved around us. In Galileo's book, entitled A Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, was published in 1632, he was surprised by the backlash of the church and the other scientists. The church acted swiftly, and within 1 year, Galileo was found guilty of heresy and placed under house arrest until his death a decade later. Galileo gets a lot of credit. He is not only in this song by Peter Mayer, but in Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody no less than five times. Galileo, Galileo. And his name is quickly mentioned whenever the merits of science against the tyranny of the church is up for discussion. Galileo deserves this credit, but he owes his mathematical model to a less famous scientist, his contemporary, Johann Kepler. Kepler expanded the Copernican mathematics to further support the idea that the planets revolved around the sun. He said that the planets traveled in elliptical or oval-shaped orbits, not perfect circles. And Kepler also said that the tides of the ocean were caused by the moon. Both ideas Galileo dismissed as fiction. But as we now know, Kepler was right. But he isn't remembered as well in history, I believe, because he was not a martyr to his cause. He was a great scientist, and he contributed to our accurate knowledge of the cosmos, but his science was in service to his faith. He believed that the structure of the solar system, Earth, Moon, Sun in particular, was a perfect metaphor for the Holy Trinity. And thus, he was not remembered for his rebelliousness or his opposition to the status quo. I don't mean to suggest that religious institutions throughout history have always been the best friend of science, but it's also unfair to suggest that they have always been its enemy. Most religious leaders throughout history were men of science. So it's interesting that only in very recent decades has that split occurred, and that's how we think of a split between science and religion. But back to Kepler and Galileo. Why was heliocentrism, the idea that the sun was the center, why was it so radical? Why was it so heretical and so upsetting? Sure, it was contradictory to what our eyes tell us, and the Bible seems to state pretty clearly that the sun rises and sets and the earth is set firmly in its foundations, but there had to have been more to it than that. I think the Peter Mayer song says it perfectly. It helped to reassure people that they were the center of the universe. Humans like being important. We like being special. In fact, I fear we are getting only more obsessed with our individuality and specialness as each generation comes and goes. America first and all that. It's true that some cultures place less emphasis on being special than others. Surely some Eastern cultures, like the Japanese, focus more on group cohesion. I remember telling my friend Lisa, she was my college friend who was a Japanese foreign exchange student, I told her that the squeaky wheel gets the grease when she was complaining of being passed over a lot in class. And she was quiet for a while, and then she said, "Huh. In Japan, we say, the male that stands up tallest gets whacked down first." So let's stick with Western culture for a while, because for better or for worse, that's the culture we find ourselves embedded within. In this culture, being the center of the universe can feel good. In our individualistic society, we like to be reassured of our specialness, our uniqueness. It makes us feel safe. Especially when we knew that God himself had placed us here and created the heavens for our purpose, like the toys placed around a baby's crib solely for her amusement. But eventually, with the help of Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and others, we came to understand that our planet was only one among many and not central in the grand scheme of things. But here on Earth, humans were still unique. We were still special. We were still the favored animals among the beasts. The second creation story in the Hebrew Bible, the one with Adam and Eve, says that God made man before he even made the animals and gave Adam the privilege of naming them and lording over them. That's not actually the case with the first creation story in the Bible, the seven-day story, but that's for another sermon. The Bible supported the centrality of human beings in God's plan, and it was obvious that humans, with our gifts of language and tool making and weaponry, were superior to other animals. The animal kingdom was arranged as a pyramid, and humans were at the top. It feels good to be king. But then on February 12th, 1809, Charles Darwin was born. Happy birthday, Charles Darwin. Darwin's claim to fame was his detailed observations of the natural environments and the world, his insights into variations among species, and of course, his theory of evolution by natural selection. The theory of evolution was not groundbreaking at the time. He was not the first to propose that we evolved. But how or why species evolved was still a mystery. Darwin's book on the origin of species challenged us to see the world as a battlefield of forces, natural elements and competition, and minute physical adaptations that led to survival or extinction. His second work, The Descent of Man, focused primarily on the evolution of humanity from a lower species. Indeed, our kinship with all vertebrates from the same common ancestor. He wrote, quote, "It's only our natural prejudice and the arrogance which made our forefathers declare that they were descended from demigods, which leads us to demur to this conclusion. But as the last century and a half has shown us, humanity's natural prejudice, our arrogance which made our forefathers declare that they were descended from demigods, is a stubborn tendency. Newspapers from Darwin's time mocked the descent of man, showing a stupid-looking monkey with the face of an elderly Darwin. The scientific community is firm in its support of evolution today, but the rise of religious fundamentalism continues to challenge Darwin's well-supported theory. As with Copernicus and Galileo, Darwin's findings challenge our sense of ourselves and our place in the cosmic order of things. It challenges the idea that we're special among animals, that we were created for some high purpose. Our ancient friend, Lucretius, believed that our adaptations were haphazard and that function followed form. Darwin agreed that mutations in physical structure only remained if their function allowed the species to thrive and survive. 2,000 years ago, Lucretius wrote, "The universe was not created for humans. Humans are part of a much larger material process that links them not only to all other life forms, but to inorganic matter as well." 2,000 years ago. I think Lucretius is talking about our interdependent web. 200 years ago, Darwin wrote, "All the foregoing rules and aids and difficulties and classification are explained, if I don't greatly deceive myself, on the view that the natural system is founded on descent with modification, that all true classification is genealogical, that community of descent is the hidden bond which naturalists have been seeking." He drew this community of descent like a tree. Let's show that tree. That's an image from Darwin's journal. The idea being that a single-celled organism was at the beginning, and with every resulting modification, there was a branch in the tree, with some species going one direction and some going the other direction. This was the origin of the idea of the phylogenetic tree. He wrote on his notes next to his picture of the tree the famous words, "I think, I might say, I wonder." His guess was that the animal kingdom is not a pyramid and humans are not at the top. Instead, he helped us to see that all of the species, plant and animal alike, are arranged in a magnificent tree, the tree of life. What's next slide? This is an illustrated version of the same phylogenetic tree. You can see on the right, the plant kingdom, on the left, the animal kingdom. We're a meaning-seeking, meaning-making species. And we do that work in communities like this one. Today, as we celebrate the life and work of Charles Darwin, the great naturalist, we remember that science tells us how. And it leaves us empty-handed with what to do with that information. Information without meaning is useless. Many people have been left in a void of meaning when it comes to evolution. If we are not the center of the universe, are we not special? If we are not God's chosen, then what purpose do we serve in the great scheme of things? We live in a world of broken people. People in need of love, in need of meaning, and in need of healing. What do our worldviews say to our desperate spirits? I would assert that a simple war of fish-shaped bumper stickers, one without feet, one with feet, one without feet, eating the one with feet. That doesn't heal anyone. So stop with all that. All questions of meaning, including the question of creation versus evolution, is not deep down what is true. The question is, what meaning does this give to my life? The poem by the children's poet Mary Ann Hoberman speaks to my spirit. She says, quote, "Do not fret and do not doubt. You are in time, you can't fall out. No matter what you say or do, you are in time. Time is in you, and everything that is to be will be in time upon this tree." The meaning is found in the great tree of life. You are in time, time is in you, and everything that is to be will be in time upon this tree. I think it's lonely at the top of the mountain. But nestled on the branch of a tree, the community of life all around us, we are part of this tree. We are surrounded by daffodils and mushrooms, apes, lemurs, whales, mockingbirds, butterflies, beetles, jellyfish. And our planet might not be alone in this universe in its capacity to harbor life. A simple thought experiment could take us to the boundaries of the universe, passing billions upon billions of stars, many of whom have orbiting planets. It seems impossible that we are completely alone in the universe. But despite humanity's and Hollywood's fascination with extraterrestrials, we have yet to find any, or even so much as a planet that could have an ocean on its surface, until just a few years ago. On December 5th, 2011, the Kepler space station, named after our friend Johann of elliptical orbit fame, confirmed the existence of a planet named Kepler-22b, which is twice the size of Earth and orbits a sun-like star in the Goldilocks zone of that star's radiation. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Kepler-22b was one of the first planets that humanity discovered, the closest we have come to finding Earth's twin. Since 2011, several other such planets and numerous other potential solar systems have been discovered. When we find an ocean on one of these planets, or even the possibility of the conditions for life as we know it, I can imagine the fallout. Our continual demotion from the center of the universe will spur fear and backlash and religious fanaticism. But rather than feeling smaller and more insignificant at each scientific finding, which is our habit, we could choose instead to see that the tree of life is growing, as becoming more intricate and magnificent. We're not alone in our special standing. We are a part of something bigger, something more beautiful, something more powerful and eternal than ourselves. And with every successive finding, it seems less and less likely that human beings should have existed in the first place, which makes our existence that much more miraculous, that much more important. There is grandeur in reality. Who am I? Who am I? Someone small, but a piece of it all. Amen. Blessed be.